So, I've got a question for all the gamers out there. Are you seriously going to miss out on one of Alienware's biggest gaming sales of the year? I mean, these are holiday prices we're talking about, so it's not just another sale. I took a look, and this is some pretty big bang for your buck. You know, it's Alienware, with some of the most advanced engineering out there, with systems at the top of reviewers' lists. And what about a gift for yourself? Gift yourself a new Alienware 16 Area 51 gaming laptop. I mean, this thing's got performance at the absolute next level with Intel Core Ultra processors. And even better, you can get it before the holidays. Plus, you can save on all kinds of displays and accessories like the Alienware 32 4K QD OLED gaming monitor for ultimate visual fidelity. These really are incredible deals on PCs with otherworldly performance. So, I'd visit Alienware.com/deals soon and grab what you can before it's too late.
Okay, it's kind of embarrassing how bad I am at budgeting.
Let me see your charges.
Ugh, fine.
You spent over $600 on takeout last month.
I can't cook. You know this.
Yes, I have had your disgusting food, but you're literally paying for a meal subscription on top of that.
Whoa, wait. That can't be right.
Look, just get Rocket Money. It shows you all of your expenses in one place and even tracks your subscriptions. And if there's a subscription you don't want, which for you, there are a lot you don't need, you can just cancel right in the app with a few taps.
So you mean I don't have to call anyone to cancel?
Nope. No hold times or anything. And they'll even try to get you a refund on some of the months of wasted money, which is a lot of money for you.
Okay.
And if you thought I was done, I'm not. The app can also help you make a budget that works for your income. Anytime you get close to your spending limits, it alerts you, so you know exactly where your money is going at all times.
All right, I'm in. What do I have to do?
Go to rocketmoney.com/cancel or download the app from the Apple or Google Play stores.
Oh yeah! When that bass drops, you don't want it to stop. It's time for DLC, your downloadable content for the week. DLC delivered the way it's meant to be, completely free. That's thanks to our sponsors this week, Super Duper, MailChimp, and Shopify. They made that possible, bringing the show to you completely free. DLC, the show all about gaming in its many forms, games played on desktops, laptops, and consoles, and also games that involve dice, luck, and cardboard. I am your host, Jeff 2Ns 1T Kanata, and I'm joined as always by my friend slash co-host slash nemesis. The guy who is always going for Roshan before kickoff, then snowballing into pushing barracks, Christian Spicer.
Hello, Christian. Hello, it's S-P-I-C-E-R on Twitter, and also the newest episode of What's New, my stand-up podcast on Nerdist, went live today, so you can check that out. Dude, I do not stay in my lane. Like, I be changing lanes like a mug, you know what I mean? Like, watch out.
Yeah, man, we are live opposite the grand finals of the International right now, which is huge, which means our live audience is got their attention diverted, I'm sure. But that's
the winner,
okay.
The winner of today's episode does get over $10 million, so there's that.
Yeah, I think that makes us competitive. It makes us competitive. Well, you know DLC. It stands for your downloadable Kanata. It stands for your downloadable Christian. But this week, oh man, DLC stands for we are damn lucky to convince this guy to come back after we bumped him last week. I'm so happy to welcome one of my favorite people in games, senior editor at Yahoo Games, Mr. Ben Silverman. Hey, Ben.
Hey, guys. Thanks for having me. I'm glad I could make it after you got to interview your divinity crush last week.
I did. It was, did you see the little hearts exploding over my head, even over audio, I think. It was... It was embarrassing and magnificent all at the same time.
I tried to listen to that episode after the RSS feed went live, but I just heard Dreamweaver playing every time you were supposed to talk, Jeff. It was weird. Yeah.
Well, I also have a crush on you, Ben. Let's not mince words here because you and I have known each other for a long time. We worked together sort of peripherally for a while. every time I run into you at an event, I'm besmitten by your charm.
And I haven't even made an awesome strategy game or role-playing game. I haven't made any games, and yet you're still smitten. I don't know why. I don't know what I've done. But yeah, I feel the same way, Jeff. It's always great seeing you. Great to be on the
awesome.
Show.
Awesome. Well, thanks for being here. All right, let's get right to it. It's time, as always. Well, we got to start the show the right way. Story of the week.
Story of the week. It's the story of the week. Story of the week. It's the story of the week.
Story of the week, of course, the part of the show where we try to convince one another of the most important story that happened in the world of gaming this week. Ben, as our guest, I would like you to have the first pick. What is your story of the week?
A lot of pressure. Well, I think the biggest story of the week might be happening right now as this Dota 2 championship is ending, but that's not what I'm going to choose. I think the biggest story has to be what's happening with Microsoft. You know, about 20,000 people were laid off from the company. And more importantly, to our interests, they have shuttered completely the Xbox Entertainment Studios division. And that's a really, really big deal, I think. Obviously, they've got a lot of shows in the works. They have, I think, the two Halo series, the one from Ridley Scott and then the kind of Halo TV series. Those are both intact. They're not actually shuttering those two. But this was a big play by Microsoft to add value to the Xbox One, to make this console or give this console an edge over the PS4, which it obviously hasn't had so far. This is an effort to compete with Netflix, and it's going the way of the dodo. I think that's a huge deal, right, guys?
It definitely is. Of course, as a listener to the show, you can submit stories for our Story of the Week consideration by using the hashtag DLCSOTW or using our Reddit at reddit.com/r/5x5DLC. This story was by far the most submitted this week. Tons of people at David Petro, at CTHomer5000, many, many more people submitted the story. So yeah, it's a big deal, especially how quickly this turnaround. Microsoft, of course, making 180 their new number over and over again. This was really just announced not too long ago that they were making this big push into video production, into original content production. But now there's a new sheriff in town. Satya Nadella came in as head of Microsoft and went, going to make some changes around here. And this is one of the things that went right to the chopping block. Christian, what's your take on losing original content? Of course, as Ben pointed out, we're not losing the movie, the Halo movie. We're not losing the Halo TV show. And it seems like they're still doing this documentary series, the what's it called? Signal to Noise, the one that about, you know, one of the episodes is about the Atari cartridges, the ET cartridges that we talked about a long time ago on the show. So there are some survivors, but for the most part, it's not going well.
Yeah, I mean, this, I feel like, goes in the unfortunate of I hate being right, or I hate being, it seems like the only person sometimes are the people that aren't involved in these companies that can predict that these things aren't going to work out. A lot of this reminds me, I don't know if you, Jeff, or you know, listeners remember, you know, back in the early days of online sketch comedy, or even like the early .com or like pets.com, I think it was spending $5 million on Super Bowl ads. And it's just like, what are you doing? Or if you were an early sketch comedy group on the internet, you know, like companies would be like, here's $20,000, go make a sketch. And you're just like, okay, we're going to go burn some money. And I mean, I don't know what they were thinking when they set up these things. It seems like Netflix is a hit and Amazon Instant, you know, Prime Video is kind of a hit, and everybody's just a race to this stuff, and Microsoft's like, we'll do it, and here's original content and throw all this money at it and it's going to be great. And then the Halo show apparently still is in development, but also apparently still in negotiations to try to have it air first on Showtime. What the heck? Arrow to the knee. Like, I just don't, like, they go in these things so half-heartedly, so halfway, that it's just, it's mind-boggling. And I understand there's a new sheriff in town and he wants to do what he's going to do or whatever, but Microsoft in general, I feel like, while I think the Xbox platform has been successful for them, they've had, the Kin was the cell phone that I think sold 100 units. You know, the Windows 7 or Mobile 7 comes out and then immediately replaced by 8, which isn't back compatible. The Surface Pro versus the Surface RT, then the Surface Pro 3. They have a lot of misses in this. And I feel like if they didn't have the war chest or the, you know, the OS dominance they have on the workplace computer, I feel like I don't know if they know what they're doing. And it stinks that these people are losing their jobs. I have friends that were, you know, pitching shows and had shows out through this program, through this service. But I mean, is it a surprise? I feel like it's not. The surprise would have been Xbox original content comes out and is a huge success, right? Like, that's the surprise.
I see in the chat room here, Eckleberry says most Hollywood deals go nowhere, and this is no exception, which is not inaccurate, but I don't think is really telling the whole story here, because this is more than just a Hollywood deal that's not going anywhere. This is an entire direction of the company that they've decided not to go in. What do you think, Ben?
Well, I think, you know, Christian, you hit the nail on the head when you said, you know, the things they have been trying haven't been working. And that's really been the story of the Xbox One since, you know, even prior to its launch, when we, you know, thought it was going to do certain things, and then it turned out it wasn't going to do certain things, and then they decided it was going to do other things. And, you know, they've had such a hard time locking down the messaging for what they want this console to be. And I think this is exactly right, that this is sort of another idea that someone came up with, like, how are we going to save this system? Not to save it, because it's not that it's failing, but how are we going to make it more compelling than the PlayStation 4? And, you know, they do have a lot of money they can throw at it, or at least they thought they had a lot of money they could throw at these shows. I didn't think it was such a bad idea, only because they have such a massive install base. If you really look at all the Xbox Live Gold subscribers out there, I don't know, I think it was 48 or 50 million or something. Mm-hmm. That's a big deal and a big show. I mean, if you have a small percentage of people who actually watch that show, if you're talking about a pool of 50 million, you're talking about a really highly rated show. If that was on television, that would be watched by a lot of people. So,
but that same 50 million people also have Netflix, and you know what I mean, like access to other things. What you need to do is convince them to use this box or this device to go into this new service to watch this show, which I'm sure Microsoft will put a lot of that stuff, you know, in your face on the console, and they'll, you know, put that stuff in the front of the dashboard or whatever. But it's not as if those 48 million people or whatever are limited to only watch that. There are so many options, and I think for better or worse, and I'm not saying that other companies shouldn't enter this field and do it better, but, you know, Netflix, I think, has kind of become the Kleenex of this area, right? Where it's, what, have you either of you watched Alpha House?
No.
No.
It's good. But no one, have you ever watched, what's that, Dead to Me? Or there's, like, you know, Hulu originals. I feel like people just don't think about that. You know, Netflix has created and put their flag down in this space, and I think such an authoritative way that it's really hard even for big players like Amazon, where you go to Amazon.com and they're pushing it in your face, and they have TV ads now for their new phone putting it in front of you. Yeah, I don't know. I think something like the Halo series stands to be successful, but the other lesser-known or original properties, I think you'd fire up your Xbox and it's like, you know, neckties or whatever. I don't know.
But it wasn't that. I mean, we went down the list a few weeks ago when they, you know, it seems like just a few weeks ago, maybe it was a few months ago.
Yesterday, but when they announced they were coming out.
Right. It seemed like very recently we had an episode where we went down the list and talked about each of these things in turn, of all the different ideas they had. And a lot of them were really cool sounding. And if the takeaway from me is that I'm really bummed out that here was really going to be a service aimed at my sensibilities. It was, hey, we're going to come up with programming that's for gamers, you know, and stuff like this Signal to Noise documentary, where you're getting a documentary series where each episode is highly produced and really cool and takes its subject matter seriously, but it's gaming related stuff. You're not getting that on Netflix. You're not getting that on Hulu. You know, we had G4 for a while that was ostensibly supposed to be that, but it never really was. It had like three shows that were kind of geared toward me, and the rest was, you know, cops and Star Trek reruns. And, you know, I thought potentially in a all download service that had this kind of install base that was geared at these kind of people, we would get really cool content, and some of the shows that they had talked about sounded awesome. And I mourn the loss of that. And it seems like the only actual service that we have for gamers now is Twitch.
Well, I mean, this is what's weird, right? Because Twitch is really popular. Let me get everything out before I dive into what's weird. But I mean, I feel like TV for gamers is video games. You know what I mean? Like, if you sit down in front of your console and turn on your TV, you'll be playing a video game. I think, and I could be
That's
wrong.
That's not true. I mean, I'm excited about this Signal to Noise documentary. I want to I'm excited about the Area 5 guys show that they're making. I dig this kind of content. I'm curious about somebody doing, you know, real weighty, interesting takes on the hobby that aren't just showing me people playing games. I want that.
Right. So I think you have an interest in that. I think that's a little different than what like G4 is trying to do, or even what I know Signal to Noise is on the Xbox One, but I guess I'm saying that we need to change this, the perception of what TV or movies for gamers is. And it's kind of what Marvel did with the shift, but they started making good Marvel movies. It's that you're not making movies for comic book fans. You're making awesome movies with these properties. And so you're making what the Area 5 guys are doing is they're making great content about people, about, you know, it's a compelling thing like Indie Game the Movie. Yes, it had video games, but it was one of my wife's favorite documentaries we watched that year because it was compelling and gripping and cool. And I think that's what makes shows compelling and awesome, not that it's, you know, here's Master Chief or this is a documentary about GameStop. It's like, this is a great piece of art, of work, of narrative, and then it happens to be about games. So it maybe gets you in the door, but it's not just lip service or fan service to these properties. Maybe I'm, you know, the weird one with that. I don't know.
Well, I think, like, you're right. I mean, King of Kong, right? That was such a great documentary, not because it was about video games, but because Billy Mitchell is such a fascinating character and kind of the story about this competition. But I agree with Jeff. I think that there's a lot of I was excited, at least, at the potential here because, you know, you're right that a great story or a great documentary or a great movie doesn't need to be about the subject matter you love. But if you happen to love the subject matter, maybe you'll be more interested in maybe not the top tier best work, but something that's just good or decent or a mediocre show or something that, you know, appeals to your interest. I mean, right now the Dota 2 championships are on, and I'm sure we'll talk a little bit about that, but I don't know anything about Dota 2. I don't play it. And I have a bit of a hard time connecting with that because I don't understand sort of the ins and outs of it. And I thought what would be cool about having a company like Microsoft who does understand the gaming space come in and start to make shows for gamers is they might be able to find ways to appeal to me and touch on those things that I do like, games that I do enjoy. I think that's why they were starting with Halo. Obviously, they know they'd get a lot of people to watch it. But if you kind of take a couple steps past that, who knows what cool stuff would come out of it. And I think it's a loss not just for consumers, people who own the Xbox One, but it's just a huge loss for Microsoft. Another one, considering that, you know, they really need to make this box more compelling than it is. And they did a good job by getting rid of Kinect you know, people now are buying it more frequently. But I think this is going to be a blow to them. This was a feather in their cap, or something that could have at least been a feather in their cap.
Yeah, I guess the other way of looking at it, you know, I agree with you, Ben. I really do. But the other way of looking at it could be that maybe they are, you know, not focusing on all the things that people criticize them at E3 for doing, or, you know, actually not this E3, but in previous years, of focusing on things that aren't the games. You know, this may be their way of saying, hey, we're not going to focus on all this other stuff that's peripheral to what games are. We're really going to focus on making a games box. I don't know. I don't think that necessarily is a mutually exclusive kind of situation. I like the idea that there's cool game-related content that isn't necessarily just games, but maybe that's the silver lining, is that they're buckling down and really making the Xbox about being a playing service instead of a watching service. Mm-hmm. Let's pivot, because you brought it up. Before I go to your story of the week, Christian, I'm assuming this is not it, but let's pivot a little bit to the international tournament, because it is huge story. I mean, the $10 million prize purse, the winner of a game that's happening right now, or the five game series, I should say, that's happening right now, walks away with $5 million. Although not a bad consolation prize for the second place, $1.5 million. You know, it's nice to get to that last game and just know, hey, worst comes to worst, $1.5 million, not too shabby. But you brought up, Ben, watching it and being a little bit, clueless about the whole thing. That's certainly how I feel. And I've been watching that noob stream. I've watched more of this tournament than I have any other Dota tournament previously. I've watched a lot of it, and I've been sticking mainly to that noob channel, which is really a cool idea. I really dig the fact that they understand, hey, here's a way for us to deliver commentary and content that is aimed at people who aren't as familiar. I'm not sure how successful it was. I really liked the initial, like during the draft phase of the matches, they did a really good job of explaining, you know, special moves and sort of move sets of the different heroes that were being selected. But when the game started, when the matches actually began, I felt like they had a really hard time breaking things down, and I didn't understand what the goals were, the sort of a baseline, like, you know, why is this person doing this at all? Not from a how do you win the game. I understand Dota enough to know how you win and how you play. I just mean, like, why do they push this particular lane? Why are they using that particular skill at this particular moment? I found that to be a hard thing to get across in such a kinetic, fast-paced game.
Yeah. That's a big problem, I think. I mean, you said it right when you talk about it being fast-paced. I think that's what I struggle with, is that there's just so much visual noise happening. And if you don't know the vocabulary, if you don't know what every, you know, who every hero is, like what every skill does and why they use this skill instead of that skill, you know, the announcers are very quick when they're, even on the noob stream, I found they were, you know, kind of quickly identifying and using abbreviations. And I was get confused if that was an ability or a team name or a player on that team. Like, I just was getting lost so quickly. Mm-hmm. And I'm comparing that to Evo, you know, which just took place. And I don't know every in and out of every Street Fighter game. I don't know, you know, every combo for every character. Certainly I'm no expert, but I can watch a fighting game tournament, and even if I don't know what's happening, I can just appreciate it because it's like, you know, Ryu and Zangief, and they're beating each other up, and Zangief has half of his health, and then all of a sudden he comes back and wins it. And I can kind of immediately get the kind of ups and downs and the thrills and the agonies, as I would with any sport, just immediately, because it's two guys fighting. Yeah. With MOBAs, I feel like if you don't know the strategies, if you don't know the players, and really if you just don't play the game, there's a barrier of entry there. I keep trying to get past. I mean, I've watched League of Legends tournaments. Now I'm trying to watch the International. And I just keep feeling like the oldest man in the world. Like, this is what my grandfather felt like watching me play the original Zelda on an NES. Like, no idea what's happening.
Yeah.
Go ahead. I'm sorry. I think to some extent, like you're saying, fighting games are maybe easier to watch with your Street Fighter example. But then there's, you know, Ultimate Marvel versus Capcom 3, where I think someone that the uninitiated watching that, it's like, what the heck is going on? I had four seizures and now someone won. Great. That's the game. and Dota, I mean, you can simplify it too, right? Where it's like, is their base destroyed or not? You know, like if you like the health, I mean, you can distill it down to this very basic thing. Yes, there's a lot going on and there's flashing and, you know, abilities and powers and moves and whatever and all this stuff happening that can be distracting. I think what makes it different than like soccer, for instance, you know, it's not quite as simple as did ball go in net. But at the same time, if you're not familiar with that game, you know, people are like, oh, it's so boring. It's just this, that, the other, or basketball or any sport, or baseball, perhaps maybe the most boring sport of all. But if you're into it, like anything, and you're watching it, it's like, okay, Pujols is up. So the outfield shifted left. The infield is playing in the middle because there's a runner on third. They're going to let him score. They want to get the out, but they're going to prevent a deep ball for, you know, like that stuff can be interesting. And commentators, you know, if you listen to it on or watch it on the MLB network, it'll be a little more in depth than, say, if you're watching it on, if it's an ABC game or whatever. So I think it's easy to dismiss things like Dota or league tournaments with like, well, it's so confusing, I just don't get it. Because I think we forget, because we've been with soccer or the NFL or MLB for so long, that all that stuff makes sense to us. Like, you just watch football now, and you're like, they put in the nickel because it's third, and you're like, yep, the nickel. What does that mean?
I agree with you, but that's why I feel like the noob stream, and I know we're all, like, half of our audience is like, guys, you guys are all idiots. But the fact that the noob stream exists is to, I think, bring you up to that level. So you go, well, Pujols is up and he tends to hit this kind of way, which means they want to have fielders in a certain position on the field to catch the ball and get him out. You know what I mean? So that's the level of, like, I don't need them to say, oh, they have to destroy somebody's base in order to win. I get that. They don't need to say, oh, they have to control the lanes in order to win, or, you know, they don't need to be talking to me like I'm a kindergartner, but I want to understand the underlying intentions.
Yeah, well, I mean, put in, it, you know, yes, it's a complicated thing. It's not unfortunately, the easiest thing to follow per se. But I think they are making an effort. And if people are interested, I mean, it's certainly getting a lot of eyeballs, right? And ESPN had it.
Yeah.
That I think if people want to put in that work, the viewer, and are interested enough, I think people will make, will be able to make the leap and figure it out, and then figure it out more and figure it out more and figure it out more until it hopefully it's ubiquitous, right? And everybody just kind of gets it. And then you have hacky stand-up comics being like, oh, and I was watching Dota with my girlfriend, and she was like, why is he out of that lane? And I was like, can you believe it?
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, I saw a cool statistic that said that the winners of the championship will make more money than the winners of the Super Bowl.
Wow.
So that's,
wow.
So that's something. That kind of puts it in perspective. All right, Christian, what is your story of the week?
So it's actually very much this. It's very much related where, as these were being on TV, Twitter handle at DJ Diddle _ you know, tweeted at both of us, Jeff, and I started replying. And the tweet was ESPN.
You always respond to diddles.
I always do. Well, on this show before, we talked about esports as sports and stuff like that. And so I think when ESPN was showing Dota, it gave DJ Diddle the opportunity to, you know, kind of express his opinion. And he tweeted at us, ESPN broadcasting Dota 2. Just a heads up, this is a sport. And, you know, I was sitting and had the time, and I went back and forth with him. And it's not, in my expert and unexpert opinion, it is not. Esports are not sports. To me, what defines a sport, and I believe is still the current definition from Merriam, or if you go into the Oxford English Dictionary, for me, the linchpin of sport is contest and physical activity. And the level of physical activity for video games competition, I say, does not meet the definition of sport. It's kind of like poker or chess, which I would not consider a sport either. But the flip side of that, I think...
NASCAR,
I would, because you... That is physically exerting. I don't know if you've ever driven a road course or raced, but it is...
Have you ever tried to input as many commands into Dota as these dudes do per minute?
No, but I can type very fast. I'm not as proficient at Dota-ing as these people, but people might...
Does it mean anything that... If you're like over 25, you're basically aged out of this entire sport because you physically can't keep up?
No, to me, that does not change my view on it. I mean, that's also, I'm trying to think of other examples. That's also true for, you know, knitting small rug knots by hand.
Which is a sport. We can agree, rug knot.
I love rug knot. I would watch that sport on the show.
And maybe if you made it a competition. But I think the thing is, what people get upset about this discussion is, and is actually my wife, Amanda, that kind of pointed this out as I was tweeting back and forth with DJ Diddle, is that I think the biggest disservice that happened to this is that it was called esports. Because by calling it esports, the comparison is already made to whether or not it is a quote-unquote real sport. And as soon as someone like me or someone else says, competitive video games isn't a real sport, I'm calling it lesser or other by having it be a fake sport. And it creates this definition of real sports and not real sports. Whereas I say there are sports and then competitions. And like, you know, people want Dota to be taken seriously, or competitive gaming to be taken seriously and have respect and not feel embarrassed when they talk about it to their parents or friends, or, you know what I mean? Like, they want it to be this serious thing. And poker never entered this type of discussion. You never hear people arguing, is poker a real sport or not? But it's on ESPN, millions of dollars of prize pool, you know, popular around the world. And I don't think it ever fell into this problem of calling it a real sport or a fake sport. It's an awesome game. It's competition. It's
sea gaming. A sea sport.
Yeah, it's a card sport. Right, exactly.
Yeah.
It never had that. So I just feel like Dota is awesome. It's great. Competitive gaming is awesome and great, and I respect it, and I admire it, and it's great. But it's not a sport. Sorry, DJ Diddle. Sorry.
Well, you know, interestingly, I don't know if you guys caught the segment on pro gaming on Real Sports on HBO, interestingly, that's what it's called. And the person who had sort of done this whole thing was on League of Legends in the huge, you know, sold-out Staples Center in 5 minutes or whatever that whole thing was. And the reporter had, at the end of it, Brian Gumbel was like, well, is this a sport? And she said, yes, absolutely. I mean, you know, again, how they click, how they train, how physically demanding it is to play these games. But I think what was sort of lost, and I always feel which is lost in this conversation, is that some games require that kind of physicality and some games don't. I mean, you're right, Jeff. At my age, there's no way I could keep up with any of these Dota 2 players or even really Call of Duty players in terms of kind of the twitch and the reaction speed. It's very difficult. But I could play Hearthstone. I could play a game that doesn't require quite the same level of right. physical skill. And so are some games considered sports? And then are some games just still considered games? I don't know if there's a way to differentiate that, but I feel like that's an important facet of this, because you know we don't consider chess to be a sport, but we consider, you know, ping pong is a sport, but billiards is a game, leisure game sport. I don't know, there's a lot of these kind of gray area games. Yeah. And I feel like that's the case with video games as well, and it's never treated that way. It's just a big blanket statement.
I think we can all agree that golf is not a sport. Right? Anybody that can play golf after a 12 pack and 300 plus pounds is not playing a sport, right? So we can agree that.
That means then, Jeff, that you're saying playing first base in the Major League Baseball also isn't a sport, because you can be 300 pounds and play that after you just drank a 12 pack also. I mean, yeah, really, I think I guess the issue.
But your definition means that any Wii game is a sport.
No, well, if it's competitive. The biggest problem, I think, is trying to shoehorn these new things into these old definitions. And I do think the brunt of the argument is about respect and about it being cool and being accepted and being mainstream. And I would just love if we could just call it competitive gaming and be proud of that and be like, you know what? It's not a sport like football, but guess what? It's better. It's better than soccer. Soccer's stupid. Golf is stupid. This is amazing. This requires faster thinking, faster twitch reactions. You know what I mean? Like, I think you can still be yeah. proud of it and put it out into the world and almost be like, yep, this is what it is. We're not ashamed of it. We're not embarrassed by it. And we're not trying to call it what your lame thing is. This is our thing. Get with it or become a grandma, which is great, by the way. Well, grandmas are great.
You know what else I'm proud of and not ashamed of? Our sponsor.
Boom.
Nice.
Our first sponsor, a new sponsor to the show, Super Duper. Super Duper is like living in Metropolis. Have you thought about living in Metropolis? What that might feel like? You're hanging out, you're doing something. Uh-oh, you tripped. Here comes a bus. Gonna hit you. Nope. Superman flies in, saves the day.
Zack Snyder destroys everything.
It's like accidents can't even happen. It's like accidents are boring because you're saved all the time. Well, guess what? That's what Super Duper does for you. All you do is install it and set it up, and it creates a bootable backup copy of your drive. You set up the backup schedule however you want, daily, weekly, whatever you want. And then when disaster strikes, because it's going to happen, it's just a matter of time. Really, this is something that happens to everybody. If it hasn't happened to you yet, it's yet. But Super Duper will swoop in like Superman and save the day. I don't know if I'm allowed to say actually Superman. I don't know if I am, but I did. Super Duper, not stepping on any trademarks, will swoop in and save the day. You just start up the drive and things are set back to the latest backup. It makes it super easy. You buy a new drive when you get a chance, install it, and have Super Duper copy the data. No panicking, no heart attacks, no stress. It's really that simple. And for a one-time fee of $27.95, the support of Super Duper is yours. Super Duper, the most boring software you'll ever love. It'll save your neck. It'll save your data. It'll save the day. Go check it out and learn more at shirt-pocket.com/superduper. That's shirt-pocket.com/superduper. We appreciate Super Duper's support of DLC and hope you support them in return. I'm surprised that that was your story of the week, Christian, although I understand because you were diddled that you wanted to bring it up. I think this Microsoft story, the international, both huge, huge stories. My personal story of the week is one that surprised me, very surprising. this article on gamesindustry.biz that four of the top MMOs make more than $100 million annually. And of those, Star Trek The Old Republic is one. This list of the top earning MMOs, I'm a huge MMO fan, as people who listen to the show are well aware. I play all of them. I love them. You know, they come and go. And I think there's this perception that when an MMO kind of falls out of vogue and isn't the game of the moment, that it all of a sudden isn't profitable anymore. It's this big loss. I think Star Wars The Old Republic in particular has a reputation of being a loss for BioWare. That is, oh my gosh, they had to go from a subscription model to a freemium model. Oh my gosh, it was this major disaster. No. Star Wars The Old Republic is making $165 million in revenue worldwide last year. And they're making that from expansion packs, from microtransactions. It's the fourth biggest MMO in the world. Of course, World of Warcraft is the top of the heap by a wide margin. It says market share of World of Warcraft is 36%, which is insane. It makes over $1 billion with a B a year. Number two, shocking, Lineage 1 from NCSoft, 9% of the market. So we drop from 1 to 2, we drop 36% to 9%. So that's huge. But still, $250 million a year for Lineage. And then number 3 is a game I really, really loved when I was playing it. I haven't played it in a while, but man, it was really fun. Terra Online. That's number 3 with 8% of the market and $236 million in revenue a year. And then Star Wars The Old Republic and Lord of the Rings Online running at the top 5. Now, this is not including the games that just launched, WildStar and Elder Scrolls Online, but I think it really should change our minds about how we talk about these games, because I think people, the pervasive opinion is MMOs are a dying breed. You know, all they do is lose money. They're these huge, risky things. It doesn't seem like that's really the case. What do you think, Ben?
Well, yeah, I find these numbers staggering. Like you, I'm totally taken aback by this revenue. I mean, this is crazy, because I totally thought and was in the camp that these games, you know, this conventional style of subscription model MMO was on its way out. But I think, you know, maybe what explains some of it is, I don't know if it, maybe two things. One, I think once you get invested in a game, whether it's an MMO, whether it's a, you know, Hearthstone, whatever it is that you're just in, you're in, and you will keep playing it. And especially if you're a spender, you know, like the way the free-to-play market works, it's always about whales, right? It's like a very small number of people are responsible for that revenue. So I'd love to see how this breaks down. You know, when they say World of Warcraft is making over $1 billion in revenue, how many people are actually contributing to that? So obviously there's the subscription itself, but how many people are doing that with the expansion packs and microtransactions for some of these games, and who's really contributing to that that bottom dollar? Because we're seeing World of Warcraft numbers dwindling. I mean, you know, we keep getting reports that fewer subscribers every year. It's going down every couple of months. So I do think it's still supported by you know, big spenders, and it's not just you're getting, you know, more and more subscribers playing the game. And then the second point is, I think there might be a pushback against the free-to-play thing. You know, it's driven everybody crazy, getting nickel and dimed for everything, you know, in-app purchases. And, you know, a lot of people don't like that anymore. They don't like what it's done to game design, what it's done to the way that games are played, the way that games are gated in terms of their content. So maybe some people are sort of saying, you know, I'm cool with subscribing, paying a certain amount of money, and I just get a game that's great that I can be a part of and continue to play it. Maybe there's a surge back to that. I don't know. I find it totally fascinating, because I, like you, I totally didn't see that coming. I thought this was going away.
Yeah. What do you think, Christian?
Yeah, I mean, it's weird. I think it's easy to cite this and as a beacon. It's crazy how much WoW still dominates the market, and there's money to be made. I wonder if that's enough.
Warlords of Draenor coming soon, baby. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I wonder if that's enough to, you know, are these profitable? I guess it's the flip side of that number, right? Or
I think $1 billion is profitable.
No, WoW clearly is, right? But as you start going down this list, at what level are they getting the return on investment? Where how long was Elder Scrolls Online and development for. And you know, there's the nitty-gritty financials of what's a write-off and what isn't, and what part of a tech is rolled into another project that then helps it keep remain viable. But I mean, I think the MMO will be around for a long, 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 long time. But I think what you are seeing, and it is a true tale of this popularity, where, you know, this was the Netflix, like we were talking about, everybody getting into original, you know, series for their exclusive video service or whatever. I mean, WoW hit, became huge, and then everyone had one. You know what I mean? Like, and I don't think you see that anymore, where now that's the MOBA world, where everybody has a MOBA, and everybody, there's a Me Too and everything. But I don't think the traditional MMO will die and go away. It will remain profitable, and, you know, people like jumping from one to the other, but I do think its heyday as being like the thing where, you know, Big Bang Theory or whatever the show was, Two and a Half Men, like, has their WoW joke in it. You know, like Second Life had that for a while, where CSI did a whole Second Life episode, right? Like, it's ridiculous. And I think we're past that for MMOs being this cultural phenomenon. But yes, they can still be profitable when done well. Sure. Why should that be a surprise?
Yeah, I guess. It was surprising to me, man. I just am shocked how many of these older games are still making gobs and gobs of money, and how wide the market seems to be. There's room for all of these. There's room for $500 million games per year. That's pretty robust, a segment of the market, if you ask me. A couple other stories I wanted to bring up. We got QuakeCon happened this week, and they debuted the new Doom, which is a reboot of the Doom franchise. There was evidently a longer video that was shown to the crowd on hand, but they had a media blackout, and they're supposedly going to go away and not show anything for a long time. They didn't want to have the video scrutinized because the game is really nowhere near ready to be shown in any kind of real way. But they teased the loyal QuakeCon crowd. I'm curious what you guys...
Yeah, is it a real reboot? I mean, is Jeremy Renner starring in it? Like, I need to know.
I'm pretty sure he is. Yeah, he's in everything. No number after the end. It's just going to be called Doom. It starts at the beginning, evidently, of Mars, you know, being colonized, and then bad demons being uncovered. And supposedly one of the most violent games any of the people there have ever seen. I saw tweets of friends who were there. Andrea Renee, one of them, saying this is the most violent game she's ever seen. I'm just curious, what do you guys think? Are you ready for a new Doom? Are you encouraged by the standing ovation that the trailer got, or that the little gameplay bit got? What do you think, Ben?
You know, in a pre-Wolfenstein New Order world, I would have not been excited about this, just because I'm kind of done with Doom. I haven't been itching for a new Doom. But after seeing what I really liked the recent Wolfenstein. Like, I think they did really great work there, and they made an old kind of really arcade style sort of shooter. They managed to bring that up to speed and make it really interesting. And they added some kind of cool progression stuff. And I just thought that was one of the coolest games released this year. So I'm now a little bit more excited about Doom and seeing what they can do with these old franchises. That being said, I think making it ultra violent and like ripping off limbs and beating players to death with them, and you know, I wonder how much of that is just, you know, because they're trying to rekindle the Doom is the most controversial game ever stuff, or they're trying to tap into that. Like, they don't really know what else to do with it, so they're just going to say, let's make it super gory and super crazy, and that'll be what gets the headlines. I'm not sure I buy that as a way to refresh Doom, but. You know, who isn't interested, at least? I mean, it's Doom. It's one of the biggest franchises ever. Like, I'm interested to see what they do with it. But that trailer also, what they released it was all kind of CG. So I didn't feel like that really gave me much insight beyond what all of our friends who were there were tweeting. And it was the same thing over and over again. Just like, I am so grossed out. This looks really cool.
Yeah. Christian, are you into it?
I agree almost exactly with what Ben said, right? Where like Wolfenstein was like, this is awesome. But my hesitance with my fear with Doom is it's on id Tech 6, like their new engine, which I guess may looked great, but that makes me scared just for even further delays and possible bugs or jankiness where, you know,
it's 1080p, 60 frames per second, they said.
I know. The promises are great. I feel like IdTech 5 had maybe a shorter life than maybe what Id was expecting, but there's no reason not to be excited about this game. I mean, I think the only reason not to be excited about it is, as of right now, it doesn't exist. And not to transition into another story, but like as Kickstarter and game development has proven time and time again, until you can buy it, there's no such thing as the game, right? But yeah, I mean, it's an iconic franchise, hopefully done right and in good hands. And I think that's a good reason to be excited about the game.
Yeah, what you're referring to, of course, is another story that was submitted by a bunch of people, including at Digital Demigod, at Quazwix. This is really messed up and sad. The Yogg's Ventures game that was a successful Kickstarter, a extremely successful Kickstarter back in 2012. It raised more than double its original goal of 250K, 570K, I think was the final tally, for the Yogg's Cast, which is something I'm not really familiar with, but evidently is extremely popular. And they wanted to make a video game based on this Yogg's Cast, and people supported it in a big way. Well, this week we heard that they stopped work on it and that no one is going to get that game, that they all paid more than, you know, what they even asked for it. They are supposedly giving Steam codes out for another game. I haven't heard which game yet, but other games to try to fulfill people's rewards. This, of course, is just another example of crowdfunding that is going bad. Unfortunately, we never really talk about the great crowdfunding projects that go well, but it is worth bringing up, not only because people submitted the story, but because it's worth repeating, you know, buyer beware. This is, you're not pre-ordering a game. You are investing in what is a risky development process. There were a great article by Phil Kohler on Polygon actually outlining all of the warning signs for this, including the fact that Wintercool Games, the developer, had never made anything before doing this and had promised the world, which is a combination that usually doesn't end well, and it did not here. So what are you guys' thoughts about this?
I mean, I think the examples of games that do well, unfortunately, we don't highlight them as their Kickstarter successes. We just talk about them as great games, but like Shovel Knight.
Well, Divinity Original Sin is a Kickstarter success. Yeah,
yes. Yeah. Baby. So they're out there and I think we sing their praises, but I think almost for the right reasons. We sing their praises for being great games, not for being Kickstarter successes, because how a game gets made, I feel like Kickstarter, you should only be wary of it. And if this thing comes out and it's great, that's great. But what you're doing is you're buying in at an early point when there is risk associated with it. And if you don't want to take on that risk, wait for the thing to come out. And if it doesn't come out, okay, then there will be something else to spend your money on. But this story, I mean, more information is coming out now where they just updated their Kickstarter with a breakdown of where the money went and stuff like that and how it was gone and how they feel like they got slighted. But man, originally when this stuff all started coming out, it just seemed like a lot of back and forth and finger pointing and no one taking accountability and rumors of people's physical rewards not even being fulfilled. And it sucks. I don't think there's any other way to put it. It sucks. And people were wronged and hurt and they put in their money into something that they believed in. And it stinks that it takes these warnings, you know what I mean, to be reminded of the dangerous proposition that this is. It's really unfortunate.
Needs more potato salad, guys. It needs more potato salad. That's the reason.
That guy's not letting anybody down.
he's gonna make a great potato salad and have a hell of a party, I guess. Yeah, I mean, Shovel Knight, that's a Kickstarter. I think FTL, wasn't that a Kickstarter? And Broken Age.
Yeah, I think you're right.
There have been tremendous Kickstarter games, but I personally am on a Kickstarter hiatus. I am not kickstarting anything right now. I feel like this is, especially with the potato salad, it has reached the point of irony, and I'm never surprised when I hear about one of these stories. It just feels like, you know, there are a couple out there that are still, I think, compelling. I think what Chris Roberts is doing with Star Citizen, and that's earning unbelievable amounts of money on Kickstarter.
Yeah.
And that's an incredibly, you know, proven developer, and you know, we're hoping that's going to be something real, but I think those are far and few between. You just see so many now that just feel like you're investing in someone's management ability more than you're investing in the actual game. You're just hoping that you're giving money to somebody and saying, "I hope you don't blow this the wrong way. That's really what it's now turned into. So I think that's exactly what they did wrong.
I mean, it seems like it was just a poor management decision. It was like money thrown at people. They had this story came out of this spending 35 grand on a dude that didn't even make anything. And it just, it's just, yeah, I think that's the problem.
I mean, you know, if you invest in the potato salad guy, you're probably going to get some potato salad. Like, you know, you're going to have a bite of potato salad. Like, it's pretty simple. He doesn't have to get, you know, an artist paid. Yeah. He's just going to make more potato salad. So, you know,
maybe that's the secret to his success, is that he kept the promises manageable.
That's right. He managed expectations right from the, he was a good manager. So I'm down with that one.
Awesome. Christian, I know that you have to leave us early today. Is there anything else you wanted to bring up? Maybe a game you played this week or anything that you wanted to mention before you have to take off?
Yeah, I do have to cut out. Thanks. Sorry to leave early. I was on the road, Vegas, for my wife and I snuck away for our 11-year wedding anniversary, which was...
Congratulations.
Thank you. It was dope, which meant more mobile time. So I'm now up to date on Walking Dead Season 2. And... I'll finish this season, but I think I'm done. I think I'm done with those Telltale games. And for me,
wow,
like, I get it. I know what it's doing. It's like, I love that. I wish other games would adopt gray area choices the way it does, and less binary, infamous Second Son, that you want to be good or bad, or, you know, like the first Dragon Age, I think, was great. I'd love to see more gray area choices. I think for me, I'll try to be as vague as possible, even for people that haven't played maybe season one. For me, I think the change in protagonist, while interesting, I think is a little, an interesting idea initially, I think is a little less interesting for me ultimately, because you're no longer really the leader of a group per se as the protagonist in season two. So I feel like your choices are maybe a little less weighty, where what you're trying to do now is, I don't mean this to have the negative connotation that it has, but you're trying to manipulate others to do the thing that you want to do, but ultimately your status in the group can't make the decision. So whereas in season one, I felt like you made the tough choices and the whole group had to live with them. Whereas in season two, you'll make a choice, but then immediately be put down. Like, we're not going to listen to you, and they'll go off. I think it makes it a little less impactful. And I guess now, the season one was my game of the year, but playing season two now, maybe I'm seeing the chinks in the armor a little bit. Where the problem for me isn't the story that I'm interacting with and the choices I'm making. The problem is in the stuff that you're not controlling or you're not making choices. I feel like it's slow and clumsy in a way that a movie or TV show isn't. Like, the cuts aren't tight enough or the action isn't fast enough. It's like in those things now, as my second time into this world, I think are made more obvious, where it's like, wow, this guy's walking animation is so slow. I know what you're trying to do from a storytelling perspective, but like, can we cut to something else already? Or like, wow, this guy's going to walk around that box. What do you do? I don't care. And so it really has lost some of its luster. I hope other people are enjoying it. And like I said, I'll finish this season. But to me, that's kind of, I think I figured out why I've fallen out of love with this game this time. I don't know. Have you played any of it, Jeff?
I played just the first episode of season two, but...
Ben, have you played any of these? Oh, so you're waiting to binge. Yeah,
I've played all through the first season. I'm now caught up like you are through season two. And I agree, especially when you talk about the protagonist change, that's impacted me more than anything. Protecting somebody is a lot different than trying to protect yourself. And I think there was an emotional connection I was able to make with the characters in the first season. I mean, really, like, I don't think I've ever made in a video game. It was my game of the year when it came out, season one. I just fell in love with it. And I have also, I think, been a little less enthused with season two. I don't know, though, if it's just because the way season two is written or because I'm also playing The Wolf Among Us and I'm going to soon be playing a Game of Thrones version and a Borderlands version, and I'm feeling a little exhausted with this style. They haven't really iterated much from the first season of The Walking Dead all the way through Wolf Among Us. It's still really the same concept, a lot of the same gameplay. I was really hoping they'd start to play with the puzzles or something so that it would, you know, maybe feel a little more gamey at times, or they would kind of what you were saying, like this, the guy walking around a box really slowly, they would eradicate that and and speed that up. But they haven't. So it's sort of the same thing. You're just doing the same thing. And the storytelling is really great, but the gameplay sort of isn't there for me that much anymore. So yeah, I'm going to finish it as well. And I finished The Wolf Among Us, but I'm starting to, you know, lose my love for it. It's losing its shine a little bit.
Yeah, well, I know this works out that I need to leave because I know you guys both played Destiny, and I'll listen to that when I get back. I hope it's awesome. Ben, great chatting. Jeff, I will talk to you again soon.
All right, buddy. Thanks a lot.
See ya.
Yeah, we will definitely talk about Destiny coming right up. But first, I need to thank MailChimp. MailChimp.com means easy email newsletters. MailChimp helps you design email newsletters, share them on social networks, integrate them with services you already use, and track your results. It's like your own personal publishing platform. You can customize your newsletter sign-up to match your brand. You can share your sign-up on your website and your Facebook page, and even collect sign-ups from an iPad or a laptop. It's also easy to import existing email lists, no matter the format. Personalize what your subscribers see, including sign-up forms and confirmation emails. And now, there has never been a better time to try MailChimp. With their entrepreneur plan, if you have under 2,000 subscribers, you can send 12,000 emails per month forever. Just visit MailChimp.com/5x5 to learn more. That's MailChimp.com/5x5 to learn more. Check out MailChimp. It's really, really cool. I have been looking at it since they became a sponsor, and it really makes it super easy. MailChimp.com/5x5. They support our show, and we hope you support them in return. Okay, it's time for the playlist. Ooh, what you playing this week? Tell us. Ooh, what you playing this week? Tell us on the playlist. It was Destiny beta weekend on the PS4. They're down for 2 days now, but they're coming back strong with Xbox One and Xbox 360. Tons of people are getting codes. I see here, Ben, that you've been playing. I was playing all weekend as well. Tell me what you did. Did you play the alpha?
I did. I played the alpha. I'm an E3 judge, and so I played. I played the alpha prior to E3. We had like a couple days, so it was just like Bungie employees, and I guess like a friends and family thing, and then like 20 or 30 E3 judges. So I played it during like a really weird chunk of time where there was just no one to play with except other journalists who, you know, were so excited. And it was also right before E3. So we were all kind of crazed and kind of frantic. And so anytime anybody could sit down and just play a video game and you're knowing you're getting work done prior to E3. So it was like people were super into it and enthused. So I play the alpha far more than I've so far played the beta. But I've been having with the beta and with the alpha just a total blast. I'm on board, man. I like this game a lot.
Yeah, me too. I didn't get a chance to play the alpha. I was out of town that weekend, but I played as much of the beta as I possibly could. I leveled to the max cap, played all the levels, and man, is that game ever fun! It feels like the love child of Halo and Mass Effect. If like Halo had the dominant genes, you know,
right.
maybe a little Borderlands is like a third cousin somewhere. But it really ramps you up into the game extremely well. You kind of get a sense of what you're supposed to do. It brings you into that world in a really effective way. The action is fun, and man, teaming up with your friends and taking down some of the challenges. I had one of the best multiplayer experiences I've ever had. We were about level 5, and three of us in a fire team, and we got the opportunity to do one of the missions. I can't remember the name of the mission, but we got an opportunity to do one of the missions on hard mode so that everybody was going to be level 8 when we were still level 5. And it said it was doable, but it would take a lot of teamwork. So we were like, oh, let's give it a shot. Oh my gosh. It felt like those halcyon days of playing the original Halo on Legendary with my buddy sitting next to each other in split screen.
Right.
I can't remember anything since then that has really reached this level of like the intense challenge, and then one person will go down and it'll be like, okay, just stay alive until my respawn meter comes up, or come grab me and respawn me. It just so intense. This mission that we were doing was there's 5 waves of of ships that drop dudes outside this little warehouse area. Mm-hmm. And the first wave is a bunch of those sort of zombie alien things. And then there's two wizards. And because there's two wizards, you have to sort of concentrate your fire on one to get his shield down so you can actually start doing some damage to him. Because if you let him off the hook for any period of time, his shield will come back. And then once those guys are down, there's another wave of just sort of fodder guys. But they're accompanied by these two sword-wielding dudes that can kill you in one hit. And that was crazy because you're like, just have to, oh, sword dude is up, sword dude is up. Everybody run, scatter, scatter, so you don't all die at once. Oh, man, it was just such fun teamwork. And because I'm such an MMO fan, it really does feel like it's got that wonderful MMO grind of getting new items and stuff. I'm hoping that there's a lot of stuff in the beta that isn't final, like walking up to characters in the tower and just seeing sort of portraits of them rather than interacting with them in any real way. They don't talk or do anything. You just kind of see this beautiful portrait of them, and then they're offering what they offer.
Get the dance out.
You do get to dance at them, and any game that has dancing is by definition an MMO. That's what I hear. Yeah, man. So, you know, what do you think? What do you think are the any problems that the game might have to overcome in order to really be spectacular? Or do you think it's got it nailed already?
Well, they jettisoned the wizard being on the moon, so they got rid of that line. Right. I think that's helped them. Now apparently they have two wizards. I don't know if your battle was on the moon. I don't think so. I think it was on.
No, you can't get to the moon in the beta. It says It's locked. Yeah.
Yeah. So we're not actually on the moon. Yeah, I mean, I agree with what you were saying. I mean, it's just sort of how this game blends other games that I love. I mean, at times it feels like you're playing, you know, some sort of Halo spinoff. At times it feels like you're playing Borderlands. At times it feels like you're playing Diablo because you're just going loot crazy. And I love how many different games reminds me of. I mean, I think the issues that I'm having right now have to do with the environments. Like, I played the alpha and I played the beta, and I feel like I'm still sort of like stuck in the same locations. And a lot of the missions that you run, you know, there's the story missions, but then you kind of go back and can kind of, you know, light up these or select these beacons, and that'll trigger new missions on sort of, mm-hmm. you know, one environment. And you kind of run across and you shoot a bunch of guys, and you run back and you shoot a bunch of guys. And it got a little repetitive. And I think that's always going to be a concern with a game of this nature. Is, you know, that's always sort of a knock with MMOs, right? Is it just the same grind over and over again? How do they introduce new elements? I think the hard mode thing is really going to be overlooked by a lot of players because you see hard and you never really want to select it. Like, I'm always intimidated to select hard, especially if it's a brand new game that I'm just getting my feet wet with. But it does change the experience. And Bungie, you know, I always forget this is Bungie, and Bungie has a track record with really some of the best first-person AI work that we've seen. Maybe not quite up to Valve standards, but they've done some really good work. And I found that the other cool thing about hard mode is it felt like the enemies were smarter, and they were kind of hiding better, and it was harder to kill them for a lot of reasons. So I hope they make that kind of more obvious and a little easier for people to get into, because I think a lot of people are going to avoid hard mode, at least at first. And then the other thing, I think the Crucible, the multiplayer mode where PvP is cool, but it's also again a little intimidating hopping into it. When I played it in the alpha, maybe it's because when I played it in the alpha, I was playing against like Bungie employees, and it was like they didn't take it easy on us. I'm like, you know, it's a bunch of E3 judges. Like, maybe try to make us feel like we're not totally lame. But they didn't. They were like, I don't care who you are.
I think they were simulating the real world environment, because even in the beta, when I just jumped in with randoms, I got slaughtered. but it does seem like the game will be, you know, playable without even having to dip into that mode should you choose not to. It seems like there's lots of stuff to do cooperatively and stuff. I'd love to get people on the phone talking about their experience with this game, because I know a lot of people are playing it this weekend. You can call into the show using our phone line 512-518-5714. That's 512-518-5714. Another thing that I thought was really cool is that first time you get the speeder bike, the hover bike, which is like, I mean, ever since I saw Return of the Jedi, I want one of those. So that's a cool wish fulfillment thing. And I think they can go really far in variety of vehicles and making, you know, it's basically mounts in an MMO. So, but they're actually way more functional here, because you can, you know, fly them anywhere you really want. and they can go really far in making those loot drops and making them, you know, customizable. Even your ship, which seems just like a graphical display at this point of like during your loading screens, if they go really far with that and making customizing your ship into something, that could all be really cool hooks as well. I don't know.
Well, I mean, they showed us that they know how to do ship combat in that Halo. Was that right? I don't remember if that was. Yeah, was that Bungie? I think that was Bungie.
That may have been 343. Was it? Yeah, I don't remember. But yeah, you're right. I remember that moment, which is really fun.
Right. It was like, oh my God, like we can fly around and shoot things too. I mean, they have a 10-year plan with this game. I would be surprised if all 10 years were on the ground. I think at some point we are going to be flying around and shooting stuff. I think it was Halo Reach. Now that I'm thinking about it, it's got to be Halo Reach because that was sort of Bungie's swan song. And I remember how awesome it was that they let us pilot a ship. So yeah, I agree. There's so much room for growth. And when you start playing the beta, you can kind of see that this is a big, big game. And we're talking about all the big kind of moments, but what really captured me with Destiny is just the attention to detail, the love they pour into this game, the environments, the way when you're walking down a tunnel, sort of like, you know, the drops of water into a pool here that, you know, insinuates that it was leaking or there was water damage, or just they create believable, special environments. They're very good at this. And this world, you know, all these different environments, I can't wait to see more. That's why I was sort of bummed out. I kept doing the same missions on that, you know, Russian, you know, base. I think there's just a ton of potential here. Tons of potential.
Let's see what the people on the phones have to say. I got somebody on the line from 401 area code. What's your name? Where are you calling from? And have you been playing Destiny?
My name is Casey, calling from Tampa, Florida. I have been playing Destiny. I think I agree with what you folks have been saying about it. I really like it, but I am also a little more concerned about the repetitive nature of it a little bit. I'm hoping that being that it is, I played the whole alpha, and I'm playing the beta as well now. I'm hoping that being that it is an alpha and a beta, they're not opening up everything to let us see it. But what I'm seeing so far has been kind of repetitive. You know, the multiplayer moments are really awesome, really fun, but it's just desolate wasteland after desolate wasteland. You know, there's never too much interaction with the environment. I'm hoping that changes, but I do love it. I think it's great.
Yeah, I would agree with that. I think one of the things that I was most disappointed with is that my, you know, venturing around into other areas, into little nooks and crannies, was not rewarded. You know, there's those loot crates that you can find every once in a while, but they were few and far between. And I felt like there were lots of places in the level where if I wandered around, a few times I wandered into some super high level enemies that were like level ?? that was like, oh, that's kind of cool that, you know, eventually when I level up, I'll be able to come back here and fight these guys. But for the most part, there wasn't a lot of density in secret stuff or just loot or things to discover. And that was a bit of a bummer.
Yeah, you get that one resource. There's like a plant. I can't remember what it's called. Steel something. There's this plant. Every once in a while, you can like pick up the plant. And so I kept, every time I'd see it, I would like hit square and pick up this plant. And I'm wondering, well, what am I doing with the plant? And are there more things like that? Like over the course of the game, am I going to have more resources to pick up? Will it be a crafting system? Like there are a lot of unanswered questions. And I think to answer your question, caller, no, we're not seeing everything at all. I think they really are holding back a ton. This, you know, you played the alpha and the beta as I did. And a lot of that content does feel the same, even though they sort of present it differently. The intro is different. You actually have an intro in the beta with the ghost kind of walking you through what's happening. You didn't really get that in the alpha. So I think they're just giving us a taste of things, but you're right. There is a repetitive nature to this game that I do hope maybe with more interactivity, or maybe with just bigger set pieces, you know, which I think is really where the game shines when you get these big sort of boss fights and you're like, I am so dialed in, there's strategy. I'm working with team like Jeff, the way you explained your really awesome experience. That's going to be the story you're going to want to tell in Destiny, not just running around getting into random fights.
Yeah, I agree. This does feel much more like a demo than a beta. It really was like, here's a few levels to whet your appetite. On the flip side of that awesome hard mode encounter that I had, there was like one of the very last missions that I had available that wasn't locked. There was, you fight this big eye that kind of looks like the Death Star. And man, that was just a test of patience, really. It was just smack the guy a whole bunch of times, and he took so long to whittle down. I felt like there could be some balancing tweaks that would make that particular fight better, and I'm hoping that a lot of those fights aren't just, you know, the boss is big because he has a really high, you know, health meter that takes forever to get down. I really like the dynamic fights that are changing, that are throwing new enemies at you. I like the fact that a couple of times it felt like Halo, in the sense that I would come upon a battle already in progress between two factions, and then I had to hop in and kill whomever I chose. I think that they're taking a lot of the great stuff from Halo and building upon it, and I think the world is rich and interesting. So I'm so excited. I'm much more excited for this than I was before I played it. That's for sure.
Yeah, it changes the experience when you get your hands on it, for sure.
I got another guy on the line here. We got, or gal, I suppose, from 845 area code. What is your name? Where are you calling from? And what is on your playlist?
Hello?
Hello. You're on the air.
Hello. Yeah, I just want to talk about the Destiny beta. Had a great time with it. Still looking forward to it. Game of the year for me. I hope.
Well, what would it take for it to not be game of the year? Is there any way that it could let you down?
Well, I was hoping, I know they're doing something new, but there was a real lack of non-playable characters that you could really interact with. I mean, you spoke about the guys on the tower, how they just kind of stood there, didn't have much interaction with them. But, I hope when I'm in the world, I hope to see more non-playable characters that you can interact with. It's emissions, and I really like the Destiny Companion app, too, where you could actually change weapons and, kind of do things. But I'm hoping there's a little bit more interactivity with that, too, is like maybe uncovering secret missions or something with the Companion app so you can interact with the game when you're not actually playing the game. I think that would be really awesome.
Yeah, Ben, did you have any experience with the Companion app at all? I never even messed with it.
I have not. Now I want to go. I want to hang up and I want to go play it. And I want to. It's off for 2 days, right? We have like a 2 day break right now. We can't play it.
Yeah,
I am so sad. But no, I definitely want to dive into that. I mean, I think the user interface is so slick and pretty. I mean, just, you know, going to my character screen and like mousing over the weapons, it's so easy to find out what's a better weapon and what's a worse weapon. I love the way they've done that.
It is odd that you are mousing over stuff, though, right? In a console game, to have a cursor, I found it to be a strange choice.
Yeah, it is, for sure. But I mean, it's going to be on the, I guess, is it going to be on the PC too? I feel like it's going to be on the PC too.
It might be. But you know, it's still, I think it's positioned primarily as a console game. Mm-hmm. Maybe that will end up making things much quicker to, you know, highlight something way down your list rather than having to scroll through. But I just thought it was an odd choice to have a cursor there waiting for me in my controller-based input.
Yeah. Well, what else can you do with the Companion app? Caller, are you still on the line? What can you do with the Companion app?
Yeah, let me unmute him here. What else can you do with the Companion app?
Well, you can kind of change your armor and weapons. You can actually... by the way, the name of the flower you're talking about is called Spin Metal, and there is a vendor on the tower that takes Spin Metal to get you, you can buy some upgraded gear and stuff like that with it.
Oh, good. So I'm not just wasting my time picking flowers.
Yeah, it's really cool. I think crafting is going to be a large part of it, and I liked how you would find those, enigmatic, whatever they were called, things to, you know, that you have to turn in to find out what the cool loot was that dropped. I think it's going to be a very robust loot system. And I guess maybe it's my experience from you know, playing over 100 hours of Diablo that makes me not as worried as other people about the variety. I just feel like, you know, it's built like one of those games where you kind of grind through a level and go back and maybe, you know, even be able to fight higher level monsters in the same environments in order to get better loots. But I hope there's lots of content. I like you guys, hope there's lots of content and lots of different environments and lots of different kinds of encounters, and that we're just seeing the tip of the iceberg. I mean, just the fact that there are vehicles, I'm hoping there are vehicles with weapons and that we get some of that sort of Halo, Warthog-esque, larger scale battles here. I can only imagine how cool that would be with my team of my fire team. And I also hope that you can have larger fire teams than just three people. I'm a little bummed that it isn't four at least, but you know, it's going to be a really cool game, and that's for sure. And it's going to be successful, so I think it'll last a while.
Yeah, and they have those vehicles, Jeff, they have those vehicles in the Crucible, in the multiplayer. They have lots of vehicles with weapons that you can...
Oh!
Yeah, they have awesome, they have, you know, turrets, they have tanks, they have kind of speedy, kind of ghost-like from Halo, kind of like quicker bikes and stuff. They have a lot of cool stuff. So yeah, hop in and got to play some of that multiplayer to get a sense of those vehicles.
I played one level of that, a capture the flag level, and I got obliterated. I was like, I'm going back to my friends and doing co-op. But I should definitely, in 2 days when it comes back up. Is there anything else on your playlist this week, Ben?
Yeah, you know, it is appropriate that I am talking to you this week, because the game that I've been playing most, other than Destiny, is a game that bridges video games and tabletop gaming. This is actually maybe a segue too. I've been playing a lot of Magic 2015 on my iPad.
Right.
I am shocked that I'm doing this, but I'm doing this.
I'm happy for you. This is awesome.
Thank you. Yeah, it's. I was at first really upset because when you I found it in the App Store and it says free, and I'm free Magic 2015. Is at this point it's just going to be like a card? Like a library, like a look through cards. It's not the actual game, but you download it and it's free for the first chapter. Like you can play through a couple different campaign, you know, missions where you battle kind of, you know, different characters and you can acquire some cards, and then you slam right into a paywall. And if you want to do anything else, if you want to play multiplayer, if you want to unlock the rest of the chapters, you have to cough up $10 and then it scales up from there. I think for $35, you can get like every card. But at first I was really upset. I'm like, this is terrible marketing. Like it doesn't say, you know, free to play with in-app purchases like Hearthstone, which is what I was expecting that I would then buy card packs if I wanted to. This is really free to try. And if you really want to play it for longer than about half an hour, you're going to have to spend money. So
I've heard a lot of people complaining about that actually.
Yeah, I was really upset, but I begrudgingly spent $10 because I really was intrigued. And I've probably played for 12 hours, maybe. I mean, awesome. I'm getting a lot out of that $10. I keep coming back to it. I think in part because I've played so much Hearthstone that I've kind of forgotten how deep and rewarding Magic really is. I mean, Hearthstone, yeah. I love the strategies, but... You know, I do sometimes get bummed out when I go on a bad losing streak in Hearthstone and I feel like I just don't have the cards to compete. And, you know, you go back to Magic and you feel like, wow, I can craft these decks. And you have an actual deck builder in this version. I can't believe it took them this long to give you the ability to fully build your own deck from scratch. But you can. And it's great. I mean, I love the new cards. There's a lot of new abilities there I've never played with before. And I'm an old school Magic guy. I played back in 94 or 95. Like I still have a bunch of like those original Magic cards. I'm sure worth some money somewhere. Yeah, but I haven't really played much since then other than the Duels of the Planeswalker series. So I'm always intrigued by this and I've just been having a blast playing it. And even though it's scary spending $10 on what you thought was a free game, you know, getting more than 10 hours out of a game for $10 to me seems like these days a pretty good deal.
I think it's a testament to how much Hearthstone has gotten its hooks into me that I haven't been playing this. I would normally be all over a new Magic release, and I haven't even downloaded it yet, but I'm definitely going to hearing good things. I was worried that some of the Magic people that I know were complaining about, in previous Duels games, you could pretty much get by just grinding and unlocking cards and, you know, having your skill get you the new decks. And it seems like at this point you really do have to pay, which is unfortunate. But as you said, Magic is still such a phenomenal game, so tight and awesome that it's hard because tomorrow, as we record this, literally tomorrow, Curse of Naxxramas comes out. So I know I'll be all over Hearthstone again. So I gotta carve out some time for Magic.
I'm about to stop playing Magic. I mean, starting tomorrow, I'll be back playing Hearthstone because I think Hearthstone is a better game, and I do think that there is. Something frustrating about, you know, Wizards of the Coast not sort of realizing they're releasing this game in a post-Hearthstone world, and CCGs now, digital versions of CCGs, have been changed forever. I mean, Hearthstone is my game of the year right now. I think for a lot of people, it's their game of the year. Yeah. and it's free to play. And so to put out a non-free to play CCG, even though it has the heft and the lore and the weight of Magic, it does feel a little like backwards, like get with the times, man, just release it for free. And if I need to, you know, grind or buy boosters, I will. So if you can get past that hump and say, okay, how good is the experience for $10 period? I think it's a pretty good experience.
Yeah. Well, I've also been playing on my iPad this week. I played a game that I heard about a while ago, but never really got around to it. But it went on sale this week for $1.99, and that is Monument Valley. Did you ever play that?
I did. I love it. It's great.
Oh, it's so fantastic. My goodness. It is, it's short, but just gorgeous. It feels to me like a mashup of that old PS3 game Echo Chrome and Eco. Or, you know, it's definitely got that Echo Chrome-y kind of, you know, M.C. Escher visual paradox kind of things that shouldn't work, making them work. What's the term for that? I can't come up with it. Optical illusion.
Yes.
The optical illusion as a gameplay trope, making, you know, if I rotate the world, making something line up, then allows my character to walk across it. But the beautiful thing about Monument Valley is that it doesn't stop there. That's where it starts. It starts with that concept, and then it keeps layering things on top. Each level layers in a brand new mechanic that keeps changing the game up and making each level seem fresh. You know, you eventually get this like companion that allows you to reach areas in different ways. You're twisting and manipulating the environments in really cool ways. It feels almost like playing with Lego or you know, twisting this clockwork contraption to make your character get to other places. And just the presentation alone is worth the $2 that I spent. It's one of the most beautiful iPad games I've ever seen. It's really special. And it kept me up way past my bedtime the other night because I was like, I'll just try the first level. And after each level, I was like, ooh, I want to see what's next. Okay, I'll just start the next level just to see what the new hook is. And then I'd finish that level and go, okay, well, I got to start the next level just to see what the new hook is. It was great. I really dug it.
Yeah, it's a really special game. And it is short. And I think a lot of people complained. Well, not a lot of people. Some people complained about that. I think it ends a little early. But, you know, kind of like what was the amazing from last year? God, I can't remember the name of it right now. The text game. It was sort of a text game. It was like reading an interactive book.
Oh, yeah, where you rotated
device,
it around.
Device 6.
Yeah.
It reminds me a little bit of that in terms of its length, which is that when you're done, right when you finish, you feel like you wish you had a little bit more, but you're not exhausted. I'm not like I'm trudging through these last three levels. You know, I finished the game. I felt satisfied that I spent the right amount of money for what I played, and I'm ready for more of it. I'm like, put out another one. I want to do this more. And I like that feeling a lot more than you know, maybe how I feel at the end of an Assassin's Creed game, which is I don't want to play Assassin's Creed again for like 2 years.
Right. Unfortunately, there's going to be another one next year.
I know. And then I'll play it and like, you know, halfway through it, I'll be like, this is great. But, you know, Monument Valley leaves you wanting more in a good way. And yeah, it's a beautiful, beautiful game.
Well, let me I want to follow up on that. But we do need to thank our second sponsor, Shopify. Shopify, the hosted e-commerce solution that allows you to set up and run your own online store in minutes. You just pick a template, add your products, pick your payment processor from PayPal to Stripe to Authorize.net, and then you ship your stuff. It's just a few clicks and you're good to go. With Shopify, it's easy to sell online and there's no software to download, host, upgrade, or maintain. You can pick from over 100 professionally designed e-commerce templates or create your own with full control over the HTML and CSS. There's no bandwidth limits and no need to worry about scaling when your store becomes popular. And every Shopify store is level 1 PCI DSS compliant and totally secure. Plus, they've just announced their Shopify Point of Sale, which is an iPad application that lets you sell your Shopify store products in a physical retail setting. It's quick and easy. Just browse your store's catalog, pick a customer's products, swipe their credit cards, and print their receipt or send it through the email. The email, he said, like an old guy. Anyway, you can automatically sync products and orders, and there's only one dashboard to manage all of your retail and online stores. So get Shopify Point of Sale hardware, which includes a credit card reader, cash drawer, iPad stand, and receipt printer. If you order online, shipping is free. So visit Shopify.com/5x5, and you'll get 3 months free. Wow,
That's pretty cool. Shopify.com/5x5 to get 3 months free. Check them out today. All you need is something to sell. Thanks for Shopify's support. We hope you support them in return. All right, I know that you've been playing some tabletop, so let's get to tabletop time.
Right now.
So, I'm looking here and seeing that you played the Dark Tower game. Tell me about that.
Oh, man. Okay, so look, just to preface this, I have an 8-month-old son, which means I don't get out of the house anymore. And I certainly don't, like, get out to play board games with friends. Like, it's maybe I squeeze in video games when I have the time right now. And obviously for work, I play games and I play a lot of mobile games. But boy, you know, an 8-month-old son means you're not, you know, having late nights playing Pathfinder at your friend's house. Although I have been playing a little bit of Pathfinder recently.
That's
so
cool.
What I actually have been playing for my birthday this year, I have asked every year I have asked my wife for a copy of Dark Tower. And as someone in the chat room is saying right now, the old 80s Dark Tower, yes. I am talking about the old 1981, this game was released, Dark Tower. And I always wanted it, never had a copy of this when I was a kid. And it was, I have friends who had it, and it was so alluring. It's basically a board game. You have kind of four quadrants, and in the middle of this board is a plastic black tower. But it's electronic. And what happens is that each player takes turns kind of trying to make their way around this map and interacting with the tower. There's like, it lights up, it spins around. If you're on like a plane or a forest tile, you tell the tower and the tower will then tell you what happens. It'll randomize, like, you're being attacked by brigands or you found a treasure or here's a dragon or whatever. And then you input little, you know, kind of how many units you have, if you want to buy more units, if you want to sell them, and you kind of play with your, you know, your units against the tower, trying to find these three keys, and then you get to unlock the tower and you fight the evil within it by making your way around this board. I know that sounds a little convoluted and a little complicated, and this is what I found out about Dark Tower, this 1981 board game I was dying to have. It's kind of a collector's item. So I finally got a chance to play it. I invited
Did you get it on eBay or something? Is that how you found it?
You know, I don't know. My wife got it for me, and she got me this. It's pristine. It is in unbelievable shape. It's got an extra light bulb because there are these little light bulbs that light up and they burn out. That was kind of one of the big problems with the game. It's got extra light bulbs. It's got like a patent, like a copy of the patent, because I guess it got into whoever had made it got into a big patent war, and in 1985, they had to stop producing the game, or 1984, they had stopped making the game. So I actually got, like, whoever sold it was like a collector of this game and like archived all this content. So it has all this material. It's so rad, dude. And anyway, I sat down finally to play it. When I was a little kid, all I would do is go to a friend's house and, like, you know, press buttons on the tower. I didn't understand how to play the game. So we read the rules and we sat down, and I think we played for a half an hour and we're just completely baffled. Like, it's the worst. It is the worst game. It's so bad. Like, this tower is so great and the rules, it's just so complicated.
Oh, no. It's like, don't meet your heroes. don't play your long lost dream of a game.
No. It's kind of like, you know, when you were a kid, I don't know, you know, when you were a kid, when you played Dungeons and Dragons and you had, you know, the Monster Manual and Player's Handbook. And you would, like, play with friends, but you didn't really necessarily play by the rules. You kind of, you know, when I was a kid in the, you know, late 70s, early 80s, you kind of make stuff up as you go, and it's really fun. And you're not really a stickler for the rules. And if you were to sit down and try to play AD&D when you were, you know, 9 years old by the rules, like hardcore, it's not really as fun. It's a lot more complicated than you would hope it would be. And that's the case with Dark Tower. I'm like, I'm going to keep it, and I'm stoked that I have it, but I don't think I'm ever going to play this game again, man.
Oh, no. That's sad. That's so sad. It's your epic journey. You finally – it's like I remember that song – well, I shouldn't bring that up on this show, but there's a song about a guy who meets Madonna, and it happened too soon. Too soon, too soon. I don't know if that's a really obscure reference, but anyway –
Yeah, that's such a bummer. It's such a bummer. You know, you kind of idolize these things and you think about them, and then when you get them, it's like, oh, this is all that was. But that's really an awesome gift, actually. We did that for TRS a long time ago. We finally got a copy of, or Dan on eBay got a copy of what is it? Volcano Island? No, Fireball Island. Fireball Island. You know, the volcano one from when we were kids. Right.
Yeah.
And we played that, and that's another game where it's like way more fun to just have adventures on the cool playset that is the game than actually play by the rules, because the rules aren't particularly good.
Right. But, yeah. Crossbows and catapults was one I remember as a kid as well. Like, you know, had these like tokens, and you would like smash these big, you know, you build castles and smash them down. But if you actually played by the rules, it kind of sucked. But if you just kind of threw these little, little tokens at each other and just kind of got into a fight with the board game pieces, it was a lot more rewarding.
Well, I got a chance to play. I teased this last week because the announcement of the Spiel des Jahres came public, which is a very prestigious German board game award. And the winner of the Kenner Spiel, which is the sort of board game for adults, for real gamers type games, was this game called Istanbul. And I got a chance to play it this week. It's designed by Rüdiger Dorn, who has designed a bunch of games in the past. Games that I liked but didn't love. Games like Goa, The Traitors of Genoa, some other games. But this game hooked me really quick. It's a really interesting idea. It's played on a modular board. So each tile, there's these big, wide tiles that you put into a grid, and you can put them, they have, you know, instructions how to make an easy version because there's a specific pattern of the grid, but you can play a random version as well. And each of the tiles is a different location in this marketplace in Istanbul. So you are playing as merchants who are trying to get 5 rubies. You win the game, at least for the 4-player version that we played. You win the game by accumulating 5 rubies first. And there's a variety of ways you can get rubies. You can purchase them outright. You can trade for them using other goods that you're getting from various places around the board. There's a variety of mechanics to get you rubies. But the central feature of the game is that it's kind of worker placement. In fact, I refer to it as almost worker abandonment, because it's not, you don't place workers, you move around that grid of tiles and leave workers in your wake. So you kind of have this stack of tokens that's almost, I imagine it as this caravan of merchants. And when you go to a location, if you want to use the action that location offers, you have to leave one of your workers there and continue moving on. And you can do that until your little stack of workers is depleted, and then you're no longer able to do any action. So you have to either go back through the map and collect them, or go to one location. One of the tiles allows all of your workers to return to your stack immediately. So it's really all about efficiency in how you drop off your guys and leaving you within a few spaces of getting back to that collection tile, so that you don't waste moves, because you can only move 2 spaces at a time. So you don't want to waste moves trying to get back and collect your guys. And there's a whole wide variety of different ways to maximize your trading. You're collecting certain kinds of goods and exchanging those certain kind of goods for money or rubies, or exchanging money for rubies. So it's got a lot of familiar worker placement mechanics as far as kind of, you know, getting these bits and exchanging them for those bits. But the central movement mechanic is so interesting and kind of works your brain in such an interesting way, because I'm constantly trying to figure out, well, is it better for me to go there? Well, oh, and the other big thing is that if another one of the players is already on a location, in order for you to land and finish your move on that location, you have to then pay that person some of your money. So you're trying to figure out, well, I don't want to pay that person money and help them out, so I'm going to try to go to a different place. And lots of layers of strategy in this game. I can totally see why it won the Kenner Spiel. It's a fantastic game. I think I'm going to purchase it myself because I had so much fun playing it. Also didn't hurt that I won my first game. But but we had a blast, man. I really dug it.
How long does a game take to complete?
Well, it was we only played it once. It was our first game, and I was learning as I was playing. So it was a little longer than normal. I would say that game is not on the tremendously long side. It's probably about 90 minutes, I would say. It's shorter than a lot of these types of of worker placement games, I found that it moved pretty quick. And if you get people who kind of can, you know, keep their turn going and don't have a lot of analysis paralysis, then you're in better shape for making a shorter experience. But it's certainly one I'm really excited to play again, and it's a game that I would really recommend. And I think it's only $40 right now online. So it's not even one of the more expensive games either.
I feel like 60 minutes up to about 90 minutes is kind of the sweet spot. I feel like when you start getting past that, when you're looking at a game that's taking, you know, 2 or 2.5 or 3 hours, I mean, there are some games where that's really all you want to do. I mean, obviously Dungeons and Dragons Adventures or Pathfinder or whatever, you can have really long sessions and they're kind of built that way. But yeah, I love board games like what you're, I mean, it sounds fascinating. So, I mean, also when you're leaving your workers, are all the workers, do they have the same abilities? Like you're just kind of dropping them off.
But yeah, you're basically using them to activate that tile. So it's the tile that you're on that gives you a certain action. So, for example, there's one tile that lets you fill up on, let's say, the red resource. You know, there's different colored resources, and they have, you know, physical representations like pineapples or whatever it is. So, you know, you land on one space and you can fill up to your maximum on your red resource. And then you can go to another space and spend that resource in certain ways. And there's different spaces that require a different proportion of resources. So maybe one will require, you know, 3 blues and 1 yellow and 1 red in order to get you a certain amount of money. And so you're trying to maximize, you know, like, okay, well, if I go over here, then I collect the maximum amount of blue that I can carry. And another space will let you increase the amount of resources that you can carry. So, but that costs money. So you need things in order to accomplish other things. And you're really trying to be as efficient as possible in accumulating all your stuff and then spending it.
I see. Yeah. I mean, that sounds like, I mean, I always feel like, you know, these sorts of games or, you know, when you get too into resource management in a board game, it can be overwhelming for new players because you're just sort of like staring at, oh my God, I've got to move this here and I've got to collect salt and I've got to collect this and I've got to collect that. But it sounds like with this being the primary mechanic, where kind of all you're doing is sort of getting these resources and making sure you have enough to you know, kind of master these tiles. It sounds like a lot easier kind of to just focus on that. You're not using the resources to do 20 other things, right?
Yeah, I mean, I wouldn't suggest people who are entirely new to designer board games pick this up as their first game. It's a bit complex for new gamers, but it's not all the way down the line to, you know, something that's really, really complex. It's a nice midweight game, and it plays relatively quickly, and it's a game that can be taught relatively easily. The only complicated part of teaching this game is explaining what each tile does. And that's really the only thing that takes a long time, is like, okay, you literally have to know what each tile does in order to start playing, because you have no idea where to go. But other than that, it's really straightforward and an elegantly designed game for sure.
Awesome. Once this kid gets older, I'm going to go get it.
Yeah, very cool. Oh, you know what? You should start with a game that's kind of similar in some ways, is Forbidden Desert. Forbidden Desert's a great game for kids. It's a cooperative game too, so you're not playing against each other. That I would highly recommend that for, you know, he's a little young yet, but, you know, pretty soon.
Yeah, right now the main game we're playing is Don't Choke on That Thing You Just Put in Your Mouth. That's the only
game
I've
played. I'm terrible at that game. I'm so bad. I choke all the time. You said you were playing Pathfinder. Are you playing the role-playing game, or are you playing the adventure card game?
The role-playing game. Actually, I played it. I mentioned that I was a judge for E3 this year, and the week before E3, a couple weeks before E3, there's a judging week, and it happens down in Los Angeles every year. And you have like kind of a number of different video game companies show stuff off. I saw you there. You were seeing, we saw some games together.
Yeah.
And so some events are just for judges. Most events are for everybody. And we're kind of stuck in LA for the whole week. And it's really like wall-to-wall video game demos. But occasionally you get a little bit of free time. And so this year, one of the other judges, the editor-in-chief of IGN, Steve Butts, had recommended that, look, we go to this thing every year, you know, we see a million video games, we're exhausted by the end of the day, and we all just like either go to a bar or have a couple drinks or just crash out. And he's like, look, we have all these gamers in town, like, why don't we play Pathfinder? And a number of us older journalists were like, that sounds great. Like, I don't want to just go, you know, PR schmooze again. Like, I would love to just hang out with guys and girls and have like a normal just like what I would do with friends. And so we did. So we played for two of the nights during Judge Week. A group of us, one of the judges, or kind of another, not a judge, but one of the other journalists was staying at a Airbnb right near the hotel we were at. So we went to his like living room, and like for two nights, we're up until like 2 or 3 in the morning playing Pathfinder.
That's awesome.
It was totally awesome, especially playing with kind of, you know, colleagues, not just friends, but colleagues and people who you know are good gamers and understand how to have fun playing a game, take it seriously, but not take it too seriously. It was just like everyone was right on the same page. That's always been a struggle for me, playing D&D with people. Is some people role play way too hard. Some people don't role play at all. And
yeah.
And it was like that perfect middle ground of people who were just trying to have a good time together. And so, yeah, we went through a whole adventure. I mean, I don't know, 10 hours worth.
It's awesome.
It's totally awesome. I love it. I'm hooked.
I DM'd a Pathfinder adventure with my normal D&D group a while back, and we liked it, but I think everybody sort of preferred 4th edition D&D just because the rules were a little less fiddly. You know, the Pathfinder rules can be pretty detailed, and I think that I also think I made a mistake in that I picked an adventure that was really freeform, open world. It was this island that you could go anywhere and do anything, and I think they felt very adrift and unfocused. And they're like, well, we don't even really know what we're trying to do. And I said, yeah, well, you just washed up on this island. You got to figure it out. Figure out why you're there and, look for clues and stuff. And I think they needed a little bit more linear kind of experience just to sort of get them into the feel of what they were doing. It was a bit of a failure. We did it for a few sessions and jumped ship and went to 4th edition D&D, which was more successful. But it's cool that you had it's a really popular game too, so a lot of people are preferring it to D&D, although I'm excited to try the new 5th edition rules, which just came out. So
yeah, have you spent any time with it yet or no?
I was one of the beta testers a long time ago and had some initial real brief encounter with it, but I'm really excited to try out the official release. I'm literally DMing tonight, and we're one session away from finishing our main campaign of the session that we're doing right now for 4th edition. And so right after that, we'll transition into 5th. And I'm very excited to try it out and see all the new fun elements that they're introducing.
Yeah, I've been hearing really good things. I mean, also, I think you guys had spoken about some of the gender changes or the ability to,
yeah.
They've been kind of waking up to, I think, what a lot of gamers are you know, sensitive about and concerned about with the direction of video games and tabletop games. And it sounds like it sounds really interesting. It sounds like a lot of big changes. I'm really anxious to play it as well.
Yeah. Acorn Neho over here is or Acorn Neho in the chat room is saying the advantage disadvantage element in 5th is great. And that's really what I'm excited about as a DM, is this a way to sort of give players a cool dice rolling advantage just for thinking outside the box and doing a really cool thing. Because I think that's the biggest challenge, especially with my group. Maybe you've run into this too. When you play with a lot of video gamers, they are trying to play D&D from a video gamer's perspective, i.e. what does the game want me to do? And I always try to encourage our gamers to think outside the box and take advantage of the fact that this is not a video game, that this is an improvisation, that we as humans can go anywhere, do anything. You don't need to just play by the rules. You can, you know, you want to try to do something crazy. It's my job as DM to figure out what that means and what the ramifications are. And I love that about, tabletop role playing, is to really figure out ways to try to break the game and put it back together.
Absolutely. I think that's why I think people would play D&D as opposed to a video game, is you have the opportunity to kind of freestyle your character and not just try to break the rules, but maybe try to not feel constrained by them. Like, the rules are there to exactly. give you guidance, you know, but they're not there to tell you what to do. And that's a fine line. I think you're right. A lot of video game players just kind of go, well, here's like a troll and I have a sword, so I'm going to swing my sword and I roll the die and I hit the guy and that's right. it. But there's 20 other ways you can get around that. And I mean, so much of it comes down to being a good DM, though. I mean, it sounds like you're an open-minded DM and you encourage that. I think some DMs don't do that and they kind of just want to stare at the rules.
Right.
So I think you're playing it the right way, Jeff. That's what I say.
Oh, thank you. I appreciate that. Well, you have been playing this show the right way, and I really appreciate you being on this week, man. And it's been so much fun. We got to have you back. Thanks so much for being here.
Absolutely. Anytime, man. I love it. I love the show. I love your the fact that you do video games, you do tabletop, you do everything here. This show's awesome. I'm a fan.
Thanks, Ben. I appreciate it. Why don't you tell the people where they can see more of your stuff this week?
Oh, boy. Well, I'm on vacation. I'm on a 5-week vacation right now. So
nice.
I know. This is the great thing about having a child and work for a company with a really nice paternity leave is I've delayed it, and now I have a summer vacation. So you can typically find my work, though, at Yahoo. If you go to games.yahoo.com, I run the entire editorial section there. So any stories you see on the front page of Yahoo, or if you dive deeper into the game section, I am in charge of that in some capacity. And then I also sometimes still do some work for Reviews on the Run, reviewsontherun.com. I do some guest hosting and review some games there as well. So I'm I try to be on TV a little bit. I'm on the internet. I mostly now just in the house cleaning up poop. That's what I do now.
Which is a lot like covering video games in a lot of ways, I'm sure.
It's a lot like being on Twitter. Yeah.
Yeah. Speaking of which, your Twitter is Ben_Silverman. So people can find you there as well. Yeah. Thank you so much for spending some of your vacation with us. And thank you for listening, everybody. We appreciate it. Christian will be back for the full episode next week. Sorry he had to cut out early, but this has been a fun one. Thanks for calling in. And we'll see you next week, every Monday, 11 a.m. Pacific time, here on the 5x5 Network. Until then, think about what you put out into the world. Make it a better place.
Marriott Bonvoy is the official hotel partner of US Soccer. Join Marriott Bonvoy today to get closer to the game with exclusive perks, unforgettable experiences, and benefits that go beyond the pitch. Spring Hill Suites, part of Marriott Bonvoy, offers complimentary hot breakfast and spacious all-suite accommodations, perfect for the whole team, with room for up to 6 guests. Make your next getaway a win. Learn more at springhillsuites.marriott.com.